I need to have like a weed sweater in the office, like a podcasting cardigan.
Happy New Year! Welcome to another episode of the Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, joined today by Ezra Klein and Sarah Cliff. We're kicking off the new year, right?
So cold.
We got the whole
gang. I was in
gang.
Montreal last week, and do you know in Montreal it was literally colder than it was on Mars?
How cold was it, Ezra?
I mean, negative 10 to 20, but that's colder than Mars, which in
but
part...
But there's breathable oxygen.
Well, that was
it's a breathable
good.
Kind of oxygen.
Don't take this from me, Matt.
You have the right to complain about that. That's freezing.
Thank you. It was
that's
very
okay to
cold.
Complain about.
It was also very cold
but
here.
But we're going to heat up the studio with some hot topics.
Some hot takes.
We have kind of a look at what didn't happen in 2017. We have a great white paper on how legislators are perceiving their constituents as more conservative than they actually are. But before we get to that, I actually have a request for my other podcast, The Impact, which just wrapped up its first season, and we're now looking at producing a second season of that show, all about local and state-level policy experiments. So interesting, different, good, bad, great, terrible things that are happening at a more local level. I am looking for some ideas of what our episodes should be about, some really novel, different things happening across the country. And I think since Weeds listeners are so tuned in to what is happening by them in the policy space, I want to know your ideas. So we set up a form where you could tell us about an interesting policy experiment happening near where you live or that you read about somewhere. I know this isn't the easiest on the podcast, but it'll also be in show notes. The link to submit your ideas, it is bit.ly/impact-season-2. That is bit.ly/impact-season-2. That's spelled out, T-W-O. Like I said, this will be in the Weeds Facebook group. It'll be in show notes. I'll tweet out a link from my Twitter account, so you should be able to find it somewhere else if you're having trouble typing it in. But we're going to start with something we touched on a little bit last week but want to dig into in more detail, which is the decline in life expectancy. So over the past 2 years, the life expectancy in the United States has gone down. And this is not normal. In other developed countries in the United States, it has been very typical for the past 4 or so decades that life expectancy goes up year after year as we get better technology, as our healthcare improves, as we learn more about extending our lives. But this year and last year, we saw life expectancy go down. The last time life expectancy went down was in the mid-1990s during the AIDS epidemic. The last time it went down 2 years in a row was in the 1960s. Before that, you'd have to go back to the 1920s to find an example. So it is really, really rare to see what we're seeing in these public health trends right now. And there was a great piece. So what has changed is it sounds a little bit small when you say it out loud. Life expectancy for an infant born in the United States, it has decreased from 78.8 2 years ago to 78.6 years. So we're talking about 0.2 years over 2 years, which it sounds small when you say it that way. But there was a great post from Bill Gardner at The Incidental Economist, which is a blog I read very regularly and would highly recommend, where he does the math on this and really shows that this is a catastrophe, that this is a huge, huge, huge change. So he works it out that, you know, we're talking about 0.1 years lost for every infant. There are 4 million births on average in the United States each year. We're talking about 400,000 years of life lost over that group of babies who will be born who were born in 2017. That's a huge change. That is more than the amount of years life lost in the Iraq War. It is a massive economic consequence.
Isn't that amazing, that particular comparison?
Yeah.
You think about how much attention, correctly, the Iraq War mm-hmm. got, and we're like looking at this and it's like a one-day story.
Well, that's among American service members.
I agree
among
with
American,
that.
Right. But, okay. For the United States.
But American yes. deaths in the Iraq War got
yes,
a lot
no,
of
no,
attention.
That was a big deal.
I agree. And I mean, it is a challenge. We talked a little bit about the causes last week. It is a challenge that is multifaceted. But I think some of the numbers that jump out when you go through the CDC report is, in the drug overdoses in the past year rose 21%. Deaths from drug overdoses. I think this is among middle-aged Americans. Sorry, not the entire cohort. But when you zoom in on middle-aged Americans, Unintentional accidents went up 10%. The causes, it is not just one thing that is happening. It is multiple things, but drug overdoses and the opioid epidemic are playing a huge role here. And I think, like you're saying, Ezra, it is something that doesn't get, you know, a report comes out from the CDC, there are headlines about it for one day, and then we kind of move on. But it's a huge change, and it's not good, and it's somewhat unprecedented in modern America.
So I want to add a couple more things onto your list here that were driving this. And we should, at some point here, talk conceptually about what we mean by driving this, because there's what makes up the bulk of death rates, right? And there's what makes up the sort of incremental change such that we are losing life expectancy. But let me bracket that for a minute. So the other two big ones here are suicides. We are seeing a huge increase in suicides in this country, and Alzheimer's disease, which is beginning to become more widespread, is killing more people. They were thinking for some time that possibly it was just a diagnostic increase and we'd actually had it for a very long time. Now they don't think that anymore. They actually think we're seeing a pretty big increase in Alzheimer's disease. And what makes this to me so striking is that it's not happening elsewhere. So Chris Ingraham at the Washington Post had a good piece on this. And what he basically showed was that in the 70s, in the 80s, you wanted to be an American. If you were the typical American baby born in 1979, you could expect to live about 73.9 years, while the typical baby born in one of the other 34 OECD, so more or less developed countries, would live roughly to age 72.3. By 2015, so before this, that's flipped. The average American born in 2015 can expect to live a little less than 79 years, while the typical baby born in those 34 OECD countries has an expected lifespan of nearly 81 years. So America is seeing its life expectancy fall behind that of other countries. And now that life expectancy is dropping further. We are not seeing those kinds of drops in other countries. We are not seeing a global rash of suicides, of unintentional injury deaths, of drug overdoses, of Alzheimer's. So something is really going wrong. And also, I want to note, it's going wrong in a way that we almost don't anymore like have the language to talk about. We think so much, we almost come to take these advances so much for granted that we really just track the health of the country through the economy, right? How's GDP doing? How are incomes doing? We don't make the sort of release of this data every year a big deal because we've come to just expect it to move up like clockwork. But this is more important than GDP. Like this is the most fundamental well-being and health of the country. Being born here, are you likely to live your sort of longest and most healthy life? And compared to a lot of other competitor countries, that is no longer true for America.
Right. And I think that's a really sort of a sobering point that we had been falling behind previously, and now it's getting worse. And it's not just that this is sort of more important than GDP, but I think it's important to emphasize because I've seen a lot of people over the past couple of years who've looked at sort of life expectancy decline, a kind of like deaths of despair narrative, and kind of like economatize the whole phenomenon.
Right.
And it's worth saying that like the recovery, the Great Recession was really bad. The recovery from the Great Recession was very weak. But that was also true in Europe. And in many ways, in large parts of Europe, it was worse there. You know what I mean? Just like the pure economic phenomenon of unemployment, sluggish recovery. Not only are countries like France and Italy, they're poorer than the United States. They have higher unemployment rates than the United States. They've had more sluggish labor markets than the United States. What they are is they are healthier. And I think it's worth, you know, actually dwelling on health as a sort of independent thing. Obviously, like lots of things in society, the extent to which you are able to develop effective public health programs depends on the economic resources that are available to you. It's like it's really hard for Namibia to have long life expectancy because it's such a poor country. But countries at the level of economic development of a Spain, an Italy, a France are clearly capable of pulling off a much greater level of population health than the United States is achieving, even though we have many more financial resources. And, you know, I mean, a lot of this is like not mysterious. Like everybody knows that like, you know, like junk food is bad for you. Everybody knows that it's good to have more physical activity in your life. I mean, we're sort of broadly familiar with the sort of long-run outlines of Americans' poor health. The fact that it's getting worse is like really frightening in a lot of ways, but it's not something that I've like ever seen a real mobilization around to even say like, here is a program that we think is going to make people healthier. Because I think everybody knows that delivering healthcare services to people who are very sick is like important, but that like that is not the way you engender population level health.
But it, so I think one thing that differentiates us aside from like junk food, those sort of things, is the lack of a healthcare system. And I think like a good example, we reported an episode of The Impact, my other podcast on how policy affects people, about maternal deaths, which feels like this trend we're seeing in life expectancy on steroids. The rate of maternal deaths in the United States has steadily increased over the past decade as it has decreased in all of our peer countries. So it's not just we are getting better slowly, like we are getting worse. More women are dying in childbirth now than 10 years ago in the United States. You are 8 times more likely to die having a baby here than you are in the United Kingdom, for example. It's just a really staggering difference. And what we looked at in that episode was that there are ways to make this better. California has done an excellent job implementing toolkits that say, okay, if this is going wrong in childbirth, here are the exact steps you follow to make sure that the mother and the baby both are able to survive. And California has a maternal death rate 3 times less than the rest of the United States. I think one of the big problems with how we treat opioids, with how we prescribe opioids, with how we manage mental health, is there is no national body in the United States to say, man, this thing in California, it really works, that less women are dying in childbirth, that it is easy to implement. It doesn't require fancy equipment. It just requires following a checklist of steps to make sure that the best methods are used. What that reporting, that story on maternal death, you know, really showed me is the lack of any sort of coordinating body to say, this works, and like, this is how we should prescribe opioids, and here's how we should deal with chronic pains, and here's what we've learned about what works best in treating opioid addiction, of applying those methods that have really worked for maternal deaths in California. They put us at a huge disadvantage. And I know maternal deaths, they're not one of the main drivers, but they are certainly a driver of increasing deaths among, you know, prime-aged women right now. And it's really sad that a lot of the solutions are out there, and it seems to be a challenge of scaling them up across a very big country that does not have things to coordinate those sort of approaches.
So a couple things here that I think are interesting. So one is that when we have this conversation, first, the overall healthcare conversation in this country is really a conversation about healthcare financing. As it happens in its policy state, we don't talk nearly enough about care delivery. We don't talk nearly enough about actually what kind of care is there, right? One thing that make healthcare much more effective in this country is if we invented a bunch of new antibiotics that were effective. We don't really talk about how to do that. Instead, we spend a lot of time talking about how to structure insurance. And that isn't to say structuring insurance is not important. It is. But we do sometimes miss that the point of insurance is what kinds of health can you buy with it? And we've not been moving that margin up nearly as fast in the past couple of decades as we had before. Another thing that I think is important to think about when you think about these numbers is that there is what is going wrong and there is what is going right, right? There's what is getting worse, so suicides, drug overdoses, and then there's what isn't getting better but could. So one thing happening in these numbers is we are seeing the decrease in cardiovascular deaths, which is a lot of that is coming from improved technology and how to treat heart problems, leveling off, right? If we had invented something or had changed the way the population is eating or smoking or whatever it might be, such that there was less heart disease killing people, these numbers could look very different. The same is true sort of on anything you can imagine. And so one thing I think is good to do when you think about life expectancy is try to think about like, what don't we talk about there, right? I mean, if we invented perfect driverless cars tomorrow, that would be an incredible boon to life expectancy in America. We have still huge, huge, huge gains we can make in tobacco regulation and smoking cessation. A huge number of people just still die from tobacco. It may not be going up, or at least I don't believe it's going up. I haven't looked at those numbers specifically. It's certainly not seeing anything like opioids are, but it's nor is it like plummeting in the way that, you know, it could. It's still much bigger than most other things. And this is one of these things where I think we have a kind of, we don't focus on this and track it and think about it. So we don't even really have a language for, you know, you could imagine putting together a commission of very smart epidemiologists and public health people and so on, and just trying to ask the question, what would be the most cost-effective ways to reduce death rates in the United States? Right? Just like, look at everything. Look at everything you can think of. What could we do for the least money that would have the biggest impact? I mean, my guess is it would probably be around tobacco and sugar. I'm pretty sold on the science around sugar being a huge cause of some of these problems, like diabetes. But whatever it is, I think it would be interesting. And it's the kind of thing that in our, I mean, the number of fucking fiscal commissions we've had in this country compared to commissions like this, it's just unbelievable. Like, we had Simpson Bowles. Now people today, Russ Douth, that had a call over the week being like, yeah, all the deficit hawks who made a huge deal out of that in 2010 were kind of wrong. Like, the amount of time we spend on some problems that are not as big a deal as dying early is pretty shocking. Final thing I'll say here real quick is that one thing when you talk about Europe or when you talk about Mexico, which has better life expectancy outcomes than you would consider from some of the other inputs to that, we just have a problem in this country that I think is pretty well documented at this point, but it's not one we know how to talk about, much less fix politically, with just loneliness and social fragmentation. That leads to unbelievably bad health outcomes for people. Loneliness, I've seen arguments that it is just as bad or worse for you than obesity and smoking. But we have a very atomized culture of aging. People get sort of walled off from folks. They end up in homes. And I'm not saying there can't be good versions of that. And I'm not saying there aren't reasons for that when it happens. I'm not here to criticize anyone. But we have a real issue with lonesomeness, with some other just ways society is structured that some other countries that are comparable to us, either in money or lower than us in money, don't. But they get a lot of help from that. The breakdown of a lot of social fabric, of religion, of unions, of bowling leagues, of all of that, that stuff comes out in these numbers. We don't really have a discourse around it, but it isn't something we should totally forget here.
But that's why I think your proposal to have like cost benefit ranking of these measures gets really difficult, right? So that like,
that's fair.
You know, more stringent tobacco regulation does not have any kind of financial cost. Right? Like the cost of that is like it's annoying to smokers. And at this point, we're sort of like below the horizon on hassling smokers as like something we all agree to. But if we were to say sharply regulate the use of added sweeteners, right, people would get very upset at that proposal. It's not that it would be too costly in a financial sense. It's that I think it's pretty clear that like eating lots of sugar is not good for you. I don't think that's controversial. I don't think it's even like tobacco science in the 80s, where there's like a large group of people who are like, no, like Jolly Ranchers are amazing health food. It's just that like people like it being available. And it's, I mean, I think it's important to tackle these kinds of topics, but the work that would need to be done is just, I think, sort of different from the work of cost-benefit analysis, whereas there probably are some things on public health, right? I mean, like Sarah's talking about maternal health interventions. That is a question where, like, we could spend more resources and, like, build better programs, and people might be skeptical of the merits of the expenditure, but we're actually costing it out, you know, makes a lot of sense, right? It's like, why are we spending, you know, whatever $1 trillion on like bombing Afghanistan when maybe helping pregnant women give birth safely would do more to improve American security. But the biggest public health wins are in this kind of, I mean, you talked, Ezra, I think on this show about the like Cleveland Clinic, like public health dystopia that they've created there. And it's, I mean, you can see why it would work, right? To like really restrict people's freedom to like make poor health choices, but also why people would resist that kind of measure.
But I think that also skirts around like the big issue in the life expectancy report is opioids. It is drug overdoses. And so I pulled up some of the stats from that. So the number of drug overdoses, it rose 21% just between 2 years, between 2015 and 2016, the number of Americans dying from drug overdoses rose 21% from 52,000 people in 2015 to 63,000 people in 2016. That is a mass, I mean, for 1 year, for a number to change 21% is just enormous. It's hard to think of other things that changed. Like when we talk about the growth of the economy, you know, I'm trying to think of like other statistics that changed that much in 1 year. Declines in teen births, for example, if they decline like 4% in between 2 years, we're like, that's a massive public health change. And I don't know we have like the solution to scale up there. This is something, you know, I've been also in my other show, The Impact, have been reporting is that one of the things that's driving this, I mean, is a massive amount of chronic pain in the United States. And the reason opioids became, you know, so pervasive in the United States is that there was a real problem that wasn't getting addressed very well. And all of a sudden this thing comes along that drug companies promise is safe and effective and does for a while seem really good at treating chronic pain. It turns out those promises about safe and effective were wrong and that these drugs were not safe and had very high risks of addiction. But I don't know, you know, when I think of like maternal death, that's a really big problem, but it seems like one where we actually have some thoughts about how to make that work better. And there are some things, you know, Armand Lopez has been reporting on some great work they've been doing in Vermont to reduce opioid addiction. But it's a hard problem and it is a big problem. And it is not normal to see in public health statistics one thing changing that much in just the span of 1 year. And I don't know what like the cost-effective solution is to opioids. I mean, if someone does who is listening, you should tell us. But it doesn't seem like it exists yet. And that seems to be really what's driving the decrease in life expectancy this year.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I will say because of that, that's part of why I say that, and you'll hear in our next segment, I have some thoughts about the idea that we should be doing more on opioids. But it's also why I say that it might be that some of the gains to be made don't come there first, right? We have to do like everything we can to deal with the opioid crisis. But I think we can look at these numbers and only think about the things that have begun going wrong when life expectancy is life expectancy, right? If you can make other things go right, that would be great too. One other just point I'll make on this, because I do think it's something important to call out in the data. America's a really big country. And so we say things like American life expectancy is going down.
True.
And like, that's true. So you've seen these big, big changes in life expectancy, but they've not been equally shared. I mean, they're much bigger for richer Americans and for poor Americans.
Yeah, there was actually a great Lancet article. I want to read a quote from it I pulled up. The life expectancy of the wealthiest Americans now exceeds that of the poorest by 10 to 15 years.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Right. So if you're poor in America, I mean, you have life expectancy you see in very poor countries. Mm-hmm. And if you're rich in America, you have some of the best life expectancy in the world.
Yes.
And like, this is a kind of inequality that is arguably the most damaging of the inequalities we have. But again, one that I don't think we talk about that much. We certainly don't have like a big plan to redress. But it's here. It's like present. And like, we are literally, you know that old line from William Gibson, the sci-fi novelist, that the future is here, it's just unevenly distributed. Like, the past is here too. It is also just unevenly distributed. A lot of people in America live in places where we've not done nearly as much to solve the infant and maternal mortality problems, where nutrition is much worse, where sanitation is worse. I mean, it's really, really awful. I know that probably too many things in the weeds end with this is awful. This will be another one of them. But I do want to use that as a transition to our next topic here, which is I've been reading a lot of the 2017 retrospectives, and they all have this quality, totally correctly and understandably, of being about what happened, right? The tax bill or the travel ban or the resistance or, you know, whatever. You pick the things that happened in politics this year or that were kept from happening in politics. One of the things I think we have trouble talking about is counterfactuals, is what didn't happen. But there's a lot of opportunity cost in the Trump administration. You have this very indisciplined, chaotic, poorly managed, unfocused administration that also is not doing a good job, I think, adapting to changing circumstances, is not doing a good job like looking to see like what could it spend its time on. And so part of the cost here is the difference between the Trump administration and a plausible administration that was using the last year to work on America's hardest problems and solve them. So I thought I'd pose a question to you all, and I've got my own answer for it too, but what should have happened in 2017? Like, what is the cost we incurred from not doing X? Because the cost we have of not solving problems, of letting them fester and get worse, or not taking opportunities to make the country better, those are real costs that we will pay in the future. And that I think we, for understandable reasons, do a pretty bad job talking about in daily political coverage.
I mean, you know, there's so many, right? I mean, part of it is, right, there's an infinite space
right,
of like problems you could tackle. But to discipline myself a little, I never thought making Donald Trump president was a good idea. But I was thinking, like, what like unexpected good things like might happen here. And Trump is a real estate developer by profession. He obviously has a deregulatory mindset. The Republican Party enjoys business-friendly deregulatory policies. And I've read in some of Trump's books stuff about how it's extremely difficult to get permission to do urban infill construction projects, which is something Donald Trump actually knows a lot about. I mean, he's often caricatured as like, he's this moron. He doesn't know anything about public policy. But like, this is a real policy issue that he's very well informed about historically, that I care about a lot. And that I think, particularly with the economy strengthening, it's like more important than ever to make it possible for people to build homes and have places to live in places where there's real economic opportunity. There was some scratchings of momentum in this direction at the end of the Obama administration. They put out a report on how we need to have more housing permitting. Hillary Clinton's campaign program, you know, was a billion pages long, but there was like 2 pages on we need to make it easier for people to build housing. California has had some baby steps in the state legislature to this. It would have been really nice to see a new Republican administration led by a real estate developer president say, you know, we're going to tackle this on a federal level. We're going to have HUD, you know, make sure its grants are aligned to making sure there's housing supply. We're going to, when we tweak the tax code, do something about this. I mean, you know, it's not primarily a federal issue, but, you know, determined people can make progress on whatever they want. And I think it's recognized by economists that sort of housing scarcity is a huge problem in the country. It seems like one that Trump, some kind of idealized version of Trump, like really could have taken on without becoming like a radically different person or someone who has a whole different worldview. But he would just still need to be like good at being president, you know, like talk to people, find out what's going on, think of things. And I mean, he isn't.
So I guess, I mean, you could use 2 different baselines for this, right? Like if we elected a Democrat versus if we elected a non-Trump Republican? Are we like in the universe of like non-Trump Republican?
I'm just saying, I'm not even saying Republican or Democrat. I think okay, you should take this how you want to take
okay
it. The point is that
need
there
more
are
rules for this.
We could have done 2017 differently.
Yes. Okay. Well, I
if
think
we
X,
had done, what yes would be the X you wish we had done?
So I think one thing actually you would have seen from either Clinton or like another version of Trump is something about drug prices. So Trump came into office again, like similar to this housing example you're talking about, in saying things that are very unorthodox for a Republican candidate about how Medicare should have the power to make deals and that the drug prices are too high and pharma's getting rich. And it is not something you typically hear from Republicans, but it is something that polls very well. When you look at like what people are frustrated with on healthcare, you know, more than their premiums, more than access to doctors, it's the price of drugs. That it's very, very expensive to buy pharmaceuticals in the United States. And there were these early gestures during the campaign, during a speech Trump gave in January 2017, just before he took office, where he said things that made it seem like this is an issue he was interested in just doing something very unorthodox on. And I think actually a Clinton administration, I would have expected, you know, there the Affordable Care Act would be there to stay and they would move on to some kind of fight about prices, and drug prices are really the place where you politically probably want to start that fight. And I think, you know, there were some meetings with pharma. This was backed off on some point. You know, former Secretary Price didn't really seem to have much interest in taking on this issue. The new nominee for HHS head, Alex Azar, comes from Pfizer. So I don't know, you know, what he's going to do on this. But I think that's one space where you could have seen a really interesting healthcare policy discussion. You know, we've talked a little bit about different ways to reward pharma that might do our country better, you know, maybe with prizes or reform of our patent system. And that's somewhere where Trump like took these initial steps and could have, you know, if you had like a more disciplined, more organized White House that would follow through on the things that the president promised, maybe you would have seen some action. And those things matter. You know, I talked about this on The Weeds before, and you like see this in my reporting, is that the problem with our healthcare system is the prices. It's not, you know, that people are going to the doctor too much. It's that they spend inordinately more each time that they do. So I think that's a missed opportunity of 2017.
So I'll go for one that I think both a Republican and a Democratic administration might have done, which is take the opioid crisis seriously and really try to orient the federal government to doing something about it. So Sarah brought
Long-time
up some—
Longtime Weeds fans will note that Sarah and I talked about this last week. We're not slighting the opioid problem.
Yeah, but Ezra
Sarah
was in
and
Canada,
Matt,
and who knows?
Sarah
you know,
and Matt don't care about the opioid crisis. They just don't care.
We
neither of
about-
them mentioned
wow.
it. They didn't bring it up. It wasn't on their list of things we could have. They just don't care. But I care. Well, and I'm going to talk about it.
Guess you don't get the weeds in Canada.
It's too cold. They can't.
The
it froze coming over the border. anyway, so last week, the weeds apparently did an amazing opioid crisis. I'm just late
great.
On this. But so 2016, most recent year, we have data. 63,000 people died from drug overdoses. Two-thirds, and given the way we report, probably more than that, of those deaths were opioid-related. And I think it's just really amazing to put this in these perspectives. That's more Americans than died from HIV and AIDS in the worst year of the plague. It's more Americans than die annually from motor accidents or from gun violence. In fact, if you look at the entire drug overdose death rate, 63,000, it's almost twice as many as die from gun violence or traffic accidents. If current trends continue, opioids could kill 650,000 people in the country over the next decade, which... You know, there's obviously you don't know the current trends will continue. It could get better. It could also get worse. So that kind of number, I mean, that is an emergency level number. I also think there's pretty good reason to believe that opioids are and so the wreckage in opioid ravaged communities is so deep that it has a lot of effects beyond just the death rate, which I think is always important to say. Obviously, every one of those people has a family. Many of them have jobs. Many of them are parents of children. Many of them support elderly parents themselves. So you see a lot of just community breakdown. You see a lot of kids left as orphans. You see a lot of parents left as single parents. So you have these terrible knock-on effects through the rest of other people's lives. There's obviously just a lot of emotional pain. So I really want to, like, this is really bad. It's really big. It is, I think it is so big that it's hard to keep stock of the numbers because they've gone up so much in the past couple of years. Now, Sarah's right. We don't have a silver bullet on opioids, but there is a lot we could be trying to do. So President Trump, after a lot of foot dragging on this, did declare a public health emergency, but he did so without using it to appropriate any new funds or really put forward anything new as a strategy. He had an opioid commission, but he's not really done anything with our recommendations. One of the members has said Trump has been all talk and no follow through.
Well, he put Kellyanne Conway in charge, though.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's so fucking insulting.
July. Right.
We should do a whole thing on that. But that I forgot that until you just mentioned it. And like my stomach just turned. You remember when Jared Kushner was going to solve the opioid crisis too?
Yeah.
Like this stuff is really bad. Anyway, so point is you could do things. So there you can go check this out. There's a great Vox article from Herman Lopez on what Vermont has been doing. They've had a pretty successful approach on opioids. You could imagine a race to the top style program where you were funding states and cities to try a lot of interventions. You were doing a good job studying them. And then you were putting funding to scale up the most effective models. Another thing that is important here, and this is another thing that Herman Lopez's reporting has taught me on this, but a huge thing that we need to do is just a cultural shift of understanding chemical addiction to something like opioids as not just a moral failing, as not really a moral failing at all. It's a chemical addiction. These things are built to make it almost impossible to stop using them. That is something that a president using the bully pulpit could do or could at least work to do to try to get Americans to think about things like opioid addiction differently. All to say, this is a hard problem. Because it is a hard problem and it's not just one easy solution, it actually makes the need for the government to focus on it in a creative, serious, sustained, like all hands on deck way more central. I think a Hillary Clinton presidency would have done that. A John Kasich presidency would have done that. Even a Chris Christie presidency would have done that. Like you can imagine a lot of different presidents taking this on as a real serious thing. But that has not happened here for many of the reasons Matt points out. Even if Trump conceptually cares about it, he doesn't care about really anything enough to focus on it. And so instead, we've burnt all this time trying to take health insurance away from people and burnt all this money giving corporations tax cuts. So that is one way in which I think there's like a real plausible other 2017 we could have had where we were really working to make progress on this. And instead, like we didn't, and we'll pay the cost of that going forward.
Well, on the opioids, though, I do want to question like how much of this is Trump specific, right? Because like we should take the American public healthcare system and just absolutely gut it, right? Just like rip out tons of money so that nobody can get health coverage. Like, that was not an eccentric Donald Trump idea. And it was not like inattention, right? Like, every single member of the Republican Party and the whole conservative movement, they absolutely believed a critical top political crisis in America was that too many people have access to Medicaid and that, like, we need to fight like hell to make sure that people can't get that health care, right? Like, that was not just like a Donald Trump thing. That's like so close to the heart of conservative ideology in America, is that, like, the government should not be helping people in need. That, like, I think that needs to be, like, seen for what it is. Like,
this is
different from, like, Trump flipping on a campaign.
No, I'm not here to defend the conservative movement on healthcare. Lord knows. But I think there are a lot of Republican governors who have taken the opioid crisis in their states more seriously. I think there are Republican candidates who would have taken this more seriously. Is there a very, very serious cross problem where it's like with the one hand, you're trying to take Medicaid away from people, and on the other, maybe you're trying to address this? Definitely. And it would have been interesting to see somebody else try to solve it. But I do not think it is hard to imagine another presidency taking this more seriously and being more focused on it and making it more of a priority. I don't think it is. I don't think opioid politics are simply one and the same as Obamacare or even broader healthcare politics.
But so, I think they're different. Which congressional Republican has, like, an interesting bill on opioids?
But Chris Christie and John Kasich did take it seriously. I mean, like, we watched them. Like, Christie ran the President's Opioids Commission and actually, like, ran a serious commission. And I think if, like, they took the recommendations more seriously, that would have been good. I'm not studied enough on members of Congress on opioids to be able to tell you much about them.
Tell us about a white paper.
Skeptical. All right. Here's an interesting paper I came across recently by David Brookman and Christopher Scovron. And it seems to be an updating of a working paper that I'd seen from them 4 or 5 years ago, but that it's actually changed somewhat what their findings are. It's called, the current title is Bias and Perceptions of Public Opinion Among Political Elites. And it's basically a study of a huge group of over 3,700 elected officials. And they're surveying what it is elected officials think their constituents think about issues, and then comparing it to actual survey evidence. And they show that people are less conservative than elected officials think that they are, and that Democrats perceive the public to be a little bit more conservative than surveys indicate that it is, and Republicans perceive the public to be way more conservative than surveys show that it is. They go through a bunch of sort of statistical tests to try to see what's going on, look at the demographics of the elected officials. They don't see much going on there. It looks like states with unified Republican control have, like, even more misperception independently of just the fact that the elected officials are Republicans. And they also show that politicians who have been in close elections recently are a little bit better informed about their constituents' views, but not a lot better. And so what they attribute this to in their current version of the research is that during the years that this study was undertaken, which is sort of, you know, the Obama presidency, conservatives were much more mobilized to engage in the public sphere, right? That Democrats and Republicans both voted. And obviously, Democrats voted in enough numbers for Obama to win twice. But Republicans were much more likely to call members of Congress, to stage demonstrations, to, you know, do things to make their voices heard. And so they find some reason to believe that that is what has sort of driven this, or did drive it during the historical period, that conservatives were much more engaged, much more active in politics, and they led politicians in general, but particularly Republican politicians, to believe that the public had very, very conservative opinions on a range of issues.
Yeah, I was interested to read this paper in the context of a recent piece that Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson wrote for Vox about why one of the things we've seen develop in Congress this year, so this is a study of state legislators, this was a piece about Congress, is that Republicans are much more willing to work on very unpopular bills, to, you know, put their necks on the line for bills that are polling 25-30%, both with healthcare, then again with tax reform. And, you know, they were raising the question and kind of an alarm, and you wrote a little bit about this afterwards, about it is really alarming to see Republicans pursuing such unpopular bills, as it suggests the will of the people becomes marginalized in politics, that there just isn't you know, usually you would think that Republicans would not, or any legislator would not, want to pursue unpopular bills out of fear of losing election. And, you know, that it could say something about the strength of polarization that they are willing to go after these popular bills because they believe that people are going to stick with the party that they've chosen and the actual legislation that they propose is going to become less consequential over time. And I thought this research added an interesting wrinkle to that theory of, if part of what is driving the pursuit of unpopular bills is hearing from constituents, vocal constituents, who like this bill. And I think they have some, you know, you talked to a lot of political scientists about the role of lobbying, about the role of donors as driving forward a lot of this unpopular legislation. But it feels at least plausible to me that some of what is going on is that it is easier to write off a poll that tells you that your healthcare bill is unpopular when you hear from like a bunch of vocal constituents are saying like you have to repeal Obamacare and like you have to get this across the finish line. And it speaks to the type of legislation that is being passed and might help unpack a little bit of, you know, this question of why are Republicans willing to go, you know, to the mat really hard for bills that people don't like.
I think there are a bunch of interesting questions raised by this. So, you know, one there is I would a little bit distinguish the case of Republicans voting for a bill they are sure everybody hates from Republicans overestimating the general conservatism of the country. Because I think one possible explanation of that is that Republicans know this bill is unpopular, but given that almost all of them are in relatively safe seats, they're more afraid of losing a primary challenge than losing a general election challenge. And so even if they had a proper view of like the general electorate, they would still vote for the unpopular thing, or they really believe in it, right? You can sort of go down a list. But I think like we are living in a world of both those questions being really important, but potentially not being the same. Something that I do think is interesting about this is I think this is a study that to me has an unusual collision with the idea that the media is very biased towards liberals, because one thing you might imagine in a country with like where the ways people learn about politics overwhelmingly are incredibly biased towards liberalism is that politicians would have like an overly liberal view of like what is going on and like what people actually believe and what they see out there. And they don't. Like, that's not what you see. And I think that the way the media is structured, where you have like a media that might have in some ways like a soft culturally liberal bias, but like tries pretty hard to report on things and in some ways is very actually open to trying to report out like the way everybody hates liberals and conservatives are angry. And so you get a lot of that. And then you have a very hard right media where you have Fox News and sort of the whole list of things that come after that. I do wonder if like that being the polls people experience, there being like all these state legislators, maybe they read like the New York Times or the Washington Post and then Fox News is like what represents the right, if that doesn't have a role in like pulling people a little bit further right. And the same for Democrats, right? I mean, you see in the same study, Democrats didn't overestimate the conservatism of the electorate by as much, but they did do it by a bit. And again, Fox News is a very hardcore conservative outlet and channel. And to the extent that conservatism is represented to people by its most extreme aspects, whereas liberalism is represented to people by institutions that are not even trying to be liberal, they're in fact trying to not be that liberal, that might be some part of why you see this.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to say that fundamentally in this iteration of the research, I think this is a pretty optimistic study compared to some other things that I've seen coming out of political science. That, you know, there was this famous like America's an Oligarchy Now paper that circulated on the internet that was purporting to show that, you know, politicians only respond to what rich people think. There's these somewhat elaborate Hacker and Pearson theories about like totally broken responsiveness of government. There's a lot of just sort of journalistic commentary to the effect of like Republicans are going ahead with what their donors want, you know, never mind the public. They are identifying in this paper, they frame this as like a problem for representative government, but this is a really innocent explanation of why Republican Party elected officials might behave in a more hard right manner than public opinion polls suggest. And their explanation is that conservative issue activists did a good job of networking with each other and with citizens and with inducing citizens to participate in the political process in a more, in a thicker way than merely voting, and that they gained like disproportionate sway over elected officials by being more engaged and being more active, right? Like, not by donations, not by like bribes, not by weird trickery, not by fake news, but by like making phone calls and like basically things you would valorize if the people doing it were doing it in support of a cause that you believed in. And where there's also, I think, if you look at 2017, good reason to believe that that has flipped. Right. That, you know, a lot of conservatives who were very alarmed by the existence of Barack Obama are more like, Trump's got it covered and liberals are engaged and there's huge marches and things like that. So if like really, really, really what's going on here is just sort of about citizen engagement and input, I'm not sure there is like any problem for Democratic theory. I mean, who knows?
Well, like, curious, we could have an interesting seminar. For this? When was the data for this
it's
collected?
2010 and 2014, right?
2012 and 2014.
I'm sorry, okay. 2012 and
yeah, so I'd be really curious to know like what the 2017, because like you've seen this year of like, I think a lot of people getting engaged in politics who weren't before. And I'm curious like if you'd see a shift in opinion follow that,
right,
or if, like if there's a lag of some sort. Well, I don't know. I'd be interested in like what it looks like in the era of Trump and if there's like a bit of flip-flopping between presidencies as people get more engaged when they oppose whoever's in the White House.
Well, and I'd especially want to see after an election, right? So like in Virginia, a bunch of Republican delegates just lost their seats. There's a bunch of newly elected Democrats. There's a bunch of longtime Democrats who like thought they could never get the majority, and then they suddenly did. Liberals are amped up, right? Like, do the newly elected Democrats in Virginia who sort of benefited from an anti-Trump wave, do they now misperceive their constituents as being incredibly progressive? Like, I don't know. I mean, that would be a fascinating follow-up research, because right now you have like really interesting research, but it's about a very particular point in time. And like now we're in a totally different dynamic. If the issue is that if elected officials misperceive the public as more conservative than it really is all the time, no matter what happens, like that's pretty disturbing. If they misperceive it because Republicans were like doing well in the midterms, like that's, I think, not that disturbing.
One of the things here that I do think is interesting as a way of possibly thinking about this is there's this long-standing and like very well-validated view in political science and public opinion research that Americans are operationally liberal and symbolically conservative. So the idea there is sort of the don't you dare let the government get its hands on my Medicare kind of thing, where people have philosophically pretty conservative opinions in America. It's why you see consistently higher numbers of Americans call themselves conservative than liberals in polling. And it's basically been that way for as long as we've been polling it. And on the other hand, they're operationally more liberal. They like government programs. They like Medicare. They like Social Security. They like public education. They like roads being good. And so they vote. The Democratic Party has traditionally been a more popular party than the Republican Party. And I wondered a little bit if you were having any kind of movement from a sense of philosophical conservatism that isn't expressing itself because legislators are much more aligned in their ideology and their party affiliation and their philosophy than most people are. So the somewhat correct idea that the country is conservative and some people that are really conservative gets moved to an idea that's more about policy than it should be. So they begin to misperceive what people's policy opinions are because of this like stronger than it should be signal of conservatism. I want to be careful because like I didn't understand some of the methodology of this paper well enough in the time I had to read it to like know that they didn't rule that out. But I thought that was interesting and didn't look to me like it was ruled out.
Just to zoom out a little bit though, one of the things that struck me about this paper is how big some of the gaps are, particularly on gun control. I know
yes.
You have the paper in front of you, Matt, but I think it was a 20 percentage point gap among Republican legislators in what they believed about certain measures on how conservative their voters were on certain gun control
measures.
Yeah, background
checks and assault weapons ban in particular.
Yeah. Like we're not talking like 5% percentage points, like a 20 percentage point gap. That's really, really big. Like I think the magnitude of this was also something that jumped out at me, particularly when you looked at gun control measures.
Yeah, I mean, it's striking that this really shows up on a number of cultural issues, right? I mean, people systematically underestimate the level of support for same-sex marriage, for background checks for guns, for assault weapons bans, and for legal abortion, all of which I think are issues where I think people perceive a preference intensity gap and are then misreading it. I mean, on guns, I think it's very clear, right, that, like, the issue is that almost everyone who has constructed their political identity around gun activism is a conservative, and that is leading legislators to wildly underrate how much just, like, regular people support gun control measures. I think it's an interesting question of, I don't know what, like, political theory as to, like, whether it's a feature or a bug of the system that the very intense preferences of gun rights activists tend to trump the, like, widely held but sort of superficial view that gun ownership should be restricted a lot. Because nothing is, there's not, like, a law against gun control people becoming single-issue voters or forming clubs around this. Like, people don't want to do it, whereas gun owners do. But it's interesting that the politicians, it's like, you looking at the charts, you can see what's happening here, but the politicians themselves don't seem to see it that way. Legislators are not self-consciously saying to themselves, I am taking an unpopular stance on background checks because of preference intensity considerations. They're talking themselves into the idea that their position is popular when it isn't.
You know, it is popular.
Recommending Vox Media Podcast Network podcasts to your friends and family.
Also joining the Weeds Facebook group, which was a really nice part of my 2017. That is one of the few nice, interesting places on the internet.
There's good people in the Weeds Facebook group.
There's good people in the Weeds Facebook
group. Garbage people elsewhere on the internet, but good people on the Weeds Facebook group.
So you should join the Weeds Facebook group. You should recommend the Weeds to your friends, other Vox Media podcasts to your friends. You should thank our producer, Peter Leonard, who is great.
We all should.
Yes.
Thank you, Peter Leonard.
Thank you. And thanks to all of you for listening. Weeds will be back on Friday.